let's say that Ronnie D'Souza will now pick up your points about the emotions and various other things. And then Pat will go on to that afterwards. And then we'll go to lunch.
Okay, well, I'm neither an optimist nor a pessimist. I'm a philosophical manic depressive. Could we have my slides? I don't know. Is there somebody in the booth?
Would you like an introduction, by the way?
Now, you see, a philosophical manic depressive is somebody who, like me, cares passionately about seeing the truth, but also knows that research shows that when you're depressed, you see the truth more clearly. So when I am depressed, I think, oh, that's great. Finally, I see the truth as it is, and this depresses me. I mean, this elates me, which, of course, in itself depresses me. I'm D'Souza. Okay, so I want to begin by telling you about how when I was in Mississippi, I had an interview with a state trooper who asked me, do you believe in God? No doubt in the line of duty, that's a question you had to ask. So I said, no, actually I don't. And he said, that sends shivers down my spine. No man can bear the burdens of this life alone. And I thought that very nicely summarized two themes of which I've heard much in this conference. One is that religion has a lot to do with community. And the other is that it has to do with the fact that you find real life elsewhere. The perfect expression of the religious sense that life is elsewhere is, of course, in Hopkins's Leaden Echo and Golden Echo, where the Leaden Echo says, be beginning to despair, despair to despair. And the Golden Echo says, spare, there is one. Yes, I have one. Hush there. Okay. So this Credo Care illustrates the importance of community and the temptation to think that life is elsewhere, just as in the Hopkins poem. Now, before I explore this a little bit, I want to say there is one more reason for us to resent faith. It's another meaning of group selection. Wilson isn't here today, but the other meaning is that if you're an individual with a psychotic belief, you're locked up and given Thorazine, but if you can get a group to share your psychotic beliefs, then you're a religion, and instead you get a tax exemption. But in fact, I want to say that religion is the price that you pay for science. Because I think it's a peculiarly human thing that underlies both science and religion, and that is the thought that you can look for imperceptible entities to explain the behavior of perceptible things. The pre-Socratics understood this, and modern science understands this, and so does religion. The difference is that the explanations that science looks for are not agents, that they are released from the tyranny of the hyperactive agent detection device. And, of course, that they need to be checked against empirical and skeptical methods. But we, as philosophers, should first admit what Peter so very eloquently said this morning, namely that most philosophy is and has been garbage. Over and over, philosophers have done hardly better than theologians in propounding theses which were propounded with utter, unshakable certainty and which contradicted other philosophers' theses propounded with equally utter certainty and which, in most cases, were garbage in the first place. Now, I think that there's something that we can derive from this other than mere derision. And that is that there is something I think we should explore to the notion of an intellectual temperament. We never persuade one another of fundamental things. I think that the occurrence of a Kantian persuading someone to being a consequentialist or vice versa is probably as frequent as religious conversion. What's more, there are inherited differences, as we were told yesterday, between individuals in the sense of fairness. Some very interesting work by Keith Jensen has shown that actually chimpanzees are perfect economic man. We're not. But chimpanzees, tested with the ultimatum game, always go for whatever they can get. This is interesting. So there is a difference in humans besides language and the other things. Now, I think that the philosophical positions of this worldliness or otherworldliness might be temperamental in this sense, and that it's worth looking into. You could test this by proposing the following parable and seeing how people react. Once upon a time, man found a pebble that looked oddly like a human face. He took it home. He loved it. He thought it was just amazing what friction by stone, sand, and water, random actions of these elements over millions of years had done, and he treasured it and displayed it in his house. But one day, a friend of him said, "Ah, I see you got one of those rejects from Nick." "Well, who's Nick?" "He's the hippie sculptor, does stuff from souvenirs. When he gets really bad, it does a really bad job, he throws it back onto the beach. Is that where you found it?" Now, all the strange, wondrous beauty the man had so much loved was gone. That's how I would feel if you persuaded me that this botched job of a world was in fact the work of an artificer, a god. Now, I think in understanding this, we need to remember something that was first broached by Paul MacLean in his work on the triune brain, when he said, when you lie down on your analyst's couch, you're really lying down with a horse and a crocodile. We have, I want to say, not a three-track, but a two-track brain. And one is, this has been mentioned before, one is, if you like, the intuitive system, the other is an analytical system and obeys essentially rules of logic and language. The two go in for what I call the LIFO-PHILO principle, which is first in, last out, and last in, first out. So the intuitive system, which is very, very efficient in its own way, has had billions of years to be refined, quickly trumps the analytic system, which has only had about 100,000 years, and in fact, really only about 3,000 years to develop the tools of mathematics and logic. That's why cognitive therapy takes more time than seeing your reasoning swamped by reason. Unfortunately, the intuitive system is profoundly illiterate and profoundly innumerate. I'm giving you here a slide from Paul Slovic's experiments, one of his many experiments that demonstrate this, in which people are asked, they're shown a very nice picture of Rokia and told that Rokia is a suffering child in Africa and deserves to be supported. And they're then shown another picture of Musia, who is also a suffering child, etc. Now, it turns out that when you show these pictures, people will give more money to one than they will give to two. The figure, the innumeracy applies to the figure two. And of course, it applies to all other figures greater than one as well. So people actually give less money when they know that lots of people need it than when they just see one picture of one person who allegedly needs it. So what to do? Three things, I suggest. Investigate cognitive temperament and find out perhaps whether it can be manipulated, despite the fact that it may be partly genetic. Explore what I call the cascade from imagination to conviction, and cultivate the enchantment of science. For the first thing, there are two things that just gave me a sense of what could happen, what could be done. One is some work that I heard talked about at a conference just a couple of weeks ago in Germany, in which somebody had looked at the the sort of syndrome that people call neuroticism. And they had found that neuroticism is highly correlated with the behavior of serotonin transporters, which in turn are highly correlated with whether you have one or two short alleles as opposed to long alleles in a certain locus on chromosome, I believe, 17. Now, it seems to me that that kind of research that is beginning to give us just a glimpse, it's no more than a glimpse, and when I mentioned this to Linas this morning, he said it was complete rubbish. But I don't claim for it anymore than it's just a glimpse of how we might begin to understand, at least to the point of being able to do something about controlling such things. The second example is some research by Yu and Dayan that explored the different activity in the brain of scientists who were confronted with merely uncertain data. And scientists, when the data became not just uncertain, but unreliably uncertain. So that this is a little bit like Rumi's distinction between unknown unknowns and known unknowns. Right? And it turns out that these are associated with different neurotransmitters. One is associated with acetylcholine and the other one with norepinephrine. So that, again, we have a tiny glimpse of something that is felt, as it were, as the greed for discovery or the fear of doing useless research, which corresponds essentially to the foraging of ants in a situation where there is a food source which is known. And some ants have to keep foraging, otherwise the next food source will remain unknown. So these are just two quick models of the kind of research that I think might be interesting. Secondly, on what I call the cascade of belief, it seems to me that religion and science both start, in the words of Yeats, where all the ladders start in the rag and bone shop of the heart, that is, in the imagination. And at that stage, when something is in our imagination, it can remain there as an aesthetic object. That is what we call art. Art is the enjoyment of known illusions, illusions known to be illusions. We call this the suspension of disbelief, but we don't call it skepticism, because it doesn't apply, since there is no temptation to believe. The trick is to find a way to stop our imagination there, in the cascade that will otherwise bring it to conviction. That is, to religion, which is not illusion, but obligatory delusion. So in addition to Dan Dennett's prescription for universal religious education, it seems to me that we should do that. We should also promote the romance of science. We know how slow it is and laborious to promote reason, but I think we should abandon our scruples about spinning, not lying, but spinning, presenting imagery, as already was suggested today, and perhaps also exploit the transgressive aspect of science. You should remind people that science really is sexy, and is sexy partly because, like sex, it is transgressive. Especially when spinning is just the alternative to lying, I think it is very much something to be recommended. Use pictures, like those beautiful pictures in the lobby, to give people a sense that moves them of the beauty and the grandeur of science. And use poetry, which is what I'll end with. I'll end with some lines with one of the most wonderful poems for the beauty and the loveliness of an atheistic view of the world. What is divinity if it can come only in silent shadows and in dreams? Shall she not find in comforts of the sun, in pungent fruit and bright green wings, or else in any balm or beauty of the earth, things to be cherished like the thought of heaven? We live in an old chaos of the sun, or old dependency of day and night, or island solitude, unsponsored, free of this wide water, inescapable. deer walk about our mountains, and the quail whistle about us their spontaneous cries. Sweet berries ripen in the wilderness, and in the isolation of the sky at evening, casual flocks of pigeons make ambiguous undulations as they sink downward to darkness on extended wings. Thank you.
Were there any questions for Ronnie? Apparently a few. Could we get one to Stuart, who was trying to ask a question last time?
These two last presentations, is this on?
Yes.
These two last presentations seems to me to be very important ones. I'd like to speak to a broadened sense of humanism. So this is really to the last two speakers. And to your, Ronnie's, ending with the poem that you ended with by Wallace Stevens. What Wallace Stevens is saying to us in that poem, unless we can't read it, is there's something beyond humanism. There's something about wonder at nature, wonder at the biosphere, wonder at what's come to exist with nothing but the sunlight falling on it for 3.8 billion years. So I think, first of all, that it's important to extend our humanism, to reach out and be inspired by what I was trying to say yesterday, the creativity in nature. It's all out, it's all around us. And then I want to raise the two questions for our political, spiritual, social consideration. We really do confront a global task in which there are a multitude of civilizations that are antique, that are being crushed into resentment. I heard you, Scott. It's not just the crushing of civilizations together. It's who played on the soccer gang together and went out and decided it'd be good to strap bombs. But the word spiritual is being avoided. And I don't think that it ought to be avoided. Being spiritual doesn't need to mean that we hold to a supernatural God who's up in heaven waving his hands around with a heaven and a hell and all of the old arguments about the theistic God. I think being spiritual is a deep part of our humanity. And I think that it can be used to work for many senses of good.
Stuart, you may think me rude, but I actually do know that there's a section this afternoon where we could even elaborate even more on this.
Oh, that's fine.
So could I ask you if Ronnie wants to make a brief response to that?
No.
Right.
Thank you.